Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. This is going to be an empowering hour, the latest on how to rejuvenate your brain naturally. Also today, we're going to look at green tea, black tea, white tea, what it does for you, and how about more on vitamin D, lots more on vitamin D, and also on coenzyme Q10. Then I'm going to take a look at our environmental segments. Today, from our public health, and this is something relatively new, a public health issue each day, something that impacts everyone in the United States. Today, we're going to look at climate problems inland, not on the ocean, not on the earthquake fault of California, Oregon, and Washington, but rather what happens if you live in a city, and we've just selected Phoenix, from William Dubois, from Tom Dispatch. Phoenix is not prepared for what lies ahead. What is that? An in-depth discussion. Now, I could apply to Phoenix the same principles to about 25 other leading cities in the United States. Then a lot of people will buy their foods from Whole Foods, mega $12 billion a year chain. I don't, for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is I don't like being misled. I don't like when they say 360, grown in California organic, and then you look on the back and you say China, where a lot of the things they've done. For example, last year, they could have helped the organic movement. They could have caused the difference in people in California voting yes to label their organic produce. Instead, they didn't support it. But they haven't supported anything. They did not support us in our challenge to the FDA over supplements and our freedoms. So what happens when you buy something that says organic from China? An interesting comment from terraforma.com and a specific commentary from Mike Adams of Natural News. Once you realize how they actually grow things in China, you may reconsider buying anything organic from China. My guest in the second part of our program today is Rashid Khalidi. He is a professor. He is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies and Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University School of International Public Affairs. He's taught at the University of Georgetown, University of Chicago, and he's very highly regarded as one of today's leading voices in the Middle East issues. And he's on the National Advisory Committee of U.S. Interreligious Committee of Peace in the Middle East. We're going to talk about how and why virtually every U.S. presidential administration has intentionally undermined, with malice aforethought, the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiation. Think not, wait till you hear what he has to say. And then you'll see that this dog and pony show that we go through in the United States. And why? Well, we're going to challenge it. Also today, I was listening to commentators mentioning the war in Iraq, the 10th anniversary. And what I didn't hear anyone discussing was what the real and future impact will be to the depleted uranium from the munitions used. Many of you came to the New York screening about 6 years ago of the Iraq-Afghan Gulf War Syndrome film I did called Friendly Fire. And at the end of the film, there was a montage of photographs of children and babies, all of whom were dead after their photographs were taken, who died shortly thereafter from cancers. All of those birth defects were because of depleted uranium and the conditions under which the kids were living, and that was just from one hospital in Fallujah. The physician who headed the hospital had over 5,000 photographs. I couldn't put 5,000 photographs in the film. It'd be as long as the film. But I certainly gave you a good representation. And it was a very touching moment because you realize these are the innocents in a conflict. Well, it's gotten a lot worse. And the American embedded media, shame on them. I forgot. They have no shame. The talking heads from NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, they don't touch this. Because to touch this would make Bill O'Reilly go even more ballistic than he usually does when someone challenges the sociopathic nature of our positioning in the world. So today I'm going to do a commentary from our public health segment based upon information that is completely documented on Iraq, the war legacy of cancer. There's two U.S.-led wars in Iraq, 1991, 2003, and they've left behind hundreds of tons of depleted uranium munitions and other toxic waste. That will kill more people, maim more people, injure more people in the coming decades than any of the 1,250,000 people who we are guessing approximately have died in Iraq. Those are just people from Iraq. So as you see, we have a lot to share. Plus this, if you're watching this program over the video, and you can going to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNall.com, I'm holding up a copy of today's New York Times. And as you can see, the entire page on the science section has got what? They've just discovered it? The New York Times just discovered solar flares. Quote, solar storms and sunspots. I guess now it's real because the New York Times, 2 years late, finally got the story. And they got it pretty right. And it says that forecast, chance of havoc. Solar eruptions that directly hit Earth are rare, but in our wired world could be crippling. Yes. Some of it, I think, would have been inspired directly from the article. Of course, we wrote the definitive article, and it's always updated, and it is completely scientifically based. And we have it posted as you hear me now. You can read this article that is far more definitive than this, but it also takes to task the fact that every member of the House of Representatives, every House member, said, yes, we have to deal with the American grid being susceptible and our power stations susceptible to being burned out because of a solar storm. That's good, until it got to the Senate. And then in come the lobbyists working with the sleazebags behind the scene. Are there any other in the Senate who then bend to the will of the special interest groups? And it was killed. Well, the fact that we do not then do anything politically about a problem doesn't mean the problem goes away. So I'm glad to see the New York Times has finally caught up. All right. Maybe you realize that there are urgencies. Because we're right now in the middle of the solar storm cycle for the next probably 9 months. And all it takes is one, just one, burst of a 20X plus or higher, and life as we know it will end in this world for at least 20% of all the inhabitants on Earth. And if it hits North America, say goodbye to everything that you knew about. It won't burn down. It won't blow up. You won't see it. But once this solar storm, if one of them hits the ground, it will burn out. If it's a high enough measurement, it will burn out all of our radar, all of our electricity, all of our substations and major stations. There is no way to replace these. There's no way to repair these. And then anywhere from 1 week to 4 weeks later, then the trouble begins. The nuclear power plants that are in that area, their backup generators will have no fuel, no electricity. 2 billion gallons of water required per day, per plant. And then you'll have Fukushima's. Then you'll see 30, 40, 50 million Americans with radiation poisoning, and that's not reversible. and cities like New York will never be inhabitable anytime in the future, ever. They should have put some of that in there. So if you want the real story, the truth of how bad it can be, all scientifically verifiable, read the article free on our website, posted again today on solar storms. We're in the cycle, but I'm glad the New York Times finally figured it out. Now for health and nutrition, the latest information. The British Medical or the British Journal of Nutrition, based upon research from Duke University, published an article that followed 19,000 women, 13,000 men, 65 years and older, in this health longevity survey. And what they found was this, and this is good. Those who drank tea every day, just one cup, were 20% lower risk of dying from any cause than those who didn't. Quote, frequency of tea intake, especially in the men, had an impact. So very important for men, you got to drink your tea. My suggestion, if you can't drink an herbal, organic tea decaffeinated each day, then just take the decaffeinated green tea capsules, 250 to 500 milligrams, once or twice a day. You'll get an enormous benefit. And that's just with dying. It also impacts cancer, breast cancer, heart attacks. Now, for those of you who are thinking about taking some nutrients, especially this time of year when you're not getting your vitamin D, take 3,000 units of vitamin D3 each day. Here's why. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition Reviews, research done at the University of Washington in Seattle. They found that when you take vitamin D, you reduce the incidence of tooth decay by 47% in children alone. That's a big difference. So get your vitamin D and give it to your kids. I got mine as a kid when my mother would, each morning when we wake up, she'd put all the boys in a row and she'd just take a bottle of olive oil and she took a spoon and she just stuffed it in her mouth. Of course, you held your breath and you swallowed it and you kind of made this strange contorted face as a kid because everybody hated cauliflower all the way it tasted. But she was right, and all those other mothers were absolutely right. You've heard me mention that an apple a day is essential for our good health. It can be a green apple because there's special chemicals in the green peel and especially good for people who are overweight and have water that they're holding. They have edema. It's a great diuretic. It's really terrific for cleansing the blood, especially if you blend it with celery and cucumber and lemon and apple. That's one of the best detoxification juices you can take. But red apples are extremely beneficial for other reasons. This is the latest from the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and it says the following. And this is from a study on apples. And they used dried apples in this case, which is terrific. It says, apples can lower cholesterol. Quote, evidence suggests that consumption of apples or its bioactive components modulate lipid metabolism and reduce the production of pro-inflammatory molecules. And then they did this study over 7 days to show this, and then they did it longer, and then they did it for a year. And it was 75 grams of apple, dried apple, a day. Now, you got 20.35 grams to an ounce. So we're talking about, you're not even talking about more than 2 ounces. A small amount. 2 ounces. That's, maybe 2 or 3 pieces of dried apple. But I also believe we should be using fresh apples as well. We are a very fat nation. We are the fattest nation in the world per population and education. We lecture the world on everything, and yet we never seem to stop long enough to look in a mirror at our own reflection of anything. We should. Because if you really want to look at yourself, look naked in a mirror, then get on a scale, then get an impedance test and ask yourself, how fat am I? What percentage of my body mass index is fat, which is lean muscle, which is water? This is important for you to know. Here's the latest study on why it's important for you to know how fat you are. From the Archives of Internal Medicine, research now shows that your body mass index, meaning how fat you are, is a better predictor of cardiovascular disease than serum cholesterol. A Dr. Feed, medical doctor and associate, University of Zurich, analyzed the data from 17,000 men and women who participated in the community health program, and what they found was that, and this was long, this was over 31 years, they found that as you start getting that abdominal fat, the belly fat, the buttock fat, the thigh fat, when you start getting that fat, you increase your risk of heart disease, stroke, and heart attack. More so than if you have an elevated cholesterol. Now, of course, what happens is this. What happens if you have a high body index of fat and you have an elevated cholesterol? Then you really are in trouble. I just got an email from a person that I assisted recently in an intervention to help this person with a protocol for cancer. The person's cancer markers were very high. His blood lipid levels were very unhealthy. He had been a couch potato. He didn't eat right, and he didn't exercise, and he smoked. And at 54, he had cancer, and it was very serious. But the family wanted him to try to get himself healthy before he went on. He had surgery, but he had cancer markers after surgery. And they said, before you do radiation and chemotherapy, how about detoxing? So I was asked, and I created a program for him, and I work with him. And he fought it. You know, he didn't like the idea of exercising because it just wasn't in his comfort zone. People tend to do what they feel most comfortable doing. But in time, he did, and at the end of 4 weeks, he went back in to get his appointment to do his chemotherapy and radiation. Good news, they said he didn't need it because he didn't have cancer markers. Even better news, he had lost the excess weight, and he had dropped 48% in his body mass index of fat from where he was to where he needed to be. He was very high. He was around 36%. Any guy who's holding 36% body fat, you are really putting yourself at risk of a heart attack. It's just you're playing Russian roulette. And now he is down to, I think it's 18%. So he had an enormous drop. Ideally, here's my suggestion. Now, there's not one that fits all. It takes into account, are you athletic? What kind of athletic participation you have? Because if you're doing overall body workout, you're going to have an overall smaller amount of fat. Why? Because runners will be burning up the fat in their leg muscles. And remember, it's when fat is stored in your muscle and there's no more room in the muscle, it spills out. So you can be over fat before you're overweight. I've actually done the impedance on hundreds and hundreds, thousands of runners on measuring their fat. They step on a scale, they hook up this electrode, and then it tells. And first, they're almost always dehydrated. That's bad. And that causes more pain in the body when you're dehydrated. And that's why one of the things I try to do is get people who have any form of inflammation to drink a lot of liquids, especially clean, healthy water. But then they think, my goodness, how can I have 27% body fat? I thought it'd be at 6% when I run 80 miles a week. Your legs are doing the running, but your arms aren't. Your back isn't. We forget that we have fat stored in cells above the waist. So it's when you're doing the curls and you're doing the push-ups and you're doing the crunches and all the other upper body dynamic exercising, that's when you end up burning the fat. But let's just say you're an average American, you're not a competitive athlete, and you want to get into the healthy range. In my opinion, the healthy range should be for a woman in the teens, 13, 14, 15% body fat. The men, 8 to 11%. To me, that would be the ideal. When we did our last health support group, the average was about 30%. By the end of it, it was down around 20%. So once again, when you burn the fat, you're releasing chemicals out of the body. That's good. Heavy metals out of the body. That's good. And you're going to save a life. And this study just shows that. And finally, vitamin D improves outcome in men with low-risk prostate cancer. This is in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, research done at the Medical University of South Carolina. And it revealed a benefit for supplementing with vitamin D among men whose prostate cancer was at a low risk of progressing into a more aggressive form. They took 4,000 units, and this was mainly African-American men. So that's important. We have an awful lot of African-American people listening to this program. So if you are taking 4,000 units of vitamin D3 a day for a year, this study showed that it made an enormous difference. Quote, of the vitamin D-treated group, 55% had fewer cancerous cores in their tissue or improved Gleason scores, which evaluate the prognosis of cancers, prostate tumors at the end of the trial. And that's good. So if you want to have a healthier prostate, one single thing you can do, there's a lot of others, is take your vitamin D3 each day. And if you want to have a better brain, according to Beth Israel Medical Center research done there and published in Resuscitation, vitamin coenzyme Q10. It's not actually a vitamin, but it's a coenzyme Q10. Quote, results study conducted which found a reduction in coenzyme Q10 among patients who died while hospitalized subsequent to resuscitation following cardiac arrest. What does this mean? If you have a heart attack and if you have good amounts of coenzyme Q10 in your body, you're more likely to be resuscitated. Well, hello, why don't we just take coenzyme Q10 every day and before we go to bed at night to help ensure that we wake up in the morning and don't need resuscitation? That's just common sense. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Here at PRN would like to thank you for helping us to hit yet another milestone. Yesterday, the station had 8,100 brand new listeners and 42,000 page views. We will continue to bring you the most comprehensive articles, documentaries, and radio programs for the progressive community in the world. Thanks again for helping us move forward.
Well, that's good news. I just heard that myself. We've been spiking up every day. Our goal is to have 10,000 new listeners a day, every day, 7 days a week. That's 70,000 new listeners a week. you're looking at the numbers, then you start to realize, gee whiz, those are serious numbers. That's over 3.5 million new listeners, and we're on the road to having that happen. And we're looking at 20 million page views. So we're very pleased, and we thank all of you for supporting that. Also, I thank people for, before we go to our guests in the commentary, let me just show you something. I was just told just now and shown from Amazon, I got this book, which we're going to offer today. It's my new book, The Joy of Juicing book. It's now on 3 bestseller lists, so thank you for doing that. This is a book that I recommend to people who want to just find how much fun there is in juicing. More Americans are juicing than ever before. And I want to do something different with this book. So with my daughter, Shelley, we started experimenting, and we came up with all these great new recipes. But then I realized how many times people say, Gary, I'm having trouble getting my mom or dad to take the pills. They're not used to them. And I know that you say they need them, and I agree, but they're just not going to take them. What do I do? So I then figured out, why not just make the juices most likely to help a person with different conditions and then include the supplements with the juices. This way you, let's say, I'll give you an example. And I have cancer, heart disease of all types, stroke, dental problems, detoxification, colon cleansing, energy and stamina, hair health, headaches. Let's just take one here. Let's see, you'll get a good one here. A pain-free potion, it's called. Now, I've got many under it, every category, hundreds here. You take oranges, limes, berries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, and boysenberries, and you throw all that into a blender, and you blend it. But then you add 450 milligrams of feverfew and 400 milligrams of potassium. It's that simple. So this way, with every single one, I give you the other nutrients you need to throw in that will help you. So that's good. All right? And wonderful recipes. But then I said, okay, what about the people who want more than just juicing recipes? So we came up with fettuccine with pesto and tomatoes. These are all vegan and gluten-free. Mushroom lasagna, zesty, a healthy Italian pizza that's gluten-free and dairy-free, spicy Texas chili, mushroom broccoli quiche, red lentil, dozens and dozens and dozens of the most delicious gourmet vegan and gluten-free and sugar-free recipes. So those are also in here. And then in the front, there's a whole section on every single item I could think of and why you should have it. In other words, if I suggest wheatgrass, you look at wheatgrass and it tells you what's in here, what's in wheatgrass, why, what makes it special. And the same is true for every fruit and vegetable and herb. And then why juicing and detoxification. So this is it. This is the brand new bestseller, Joy of Juicing. And what we're going to do today, and I can only do it today, and this is the only day we can do it, because while I was out on the road for the last 10 weeks, Jeremy here bought 200 copies from my publisher. So when you call today, we're going to give you The Joy of Juicing, plus my brand new documentary. I just aired this on PBS in Denver, The Joy of Juicing documentary. And very little of it's about juicing. Everything else about it is how we get sick and all the top doctors, holistic doctors, Dr. John McDougall and Dr. Neil Barnard and Dr. Joel Fuhrman and all these other doctors are in there talking about why we get sick and what to do. They're all vegan and they all juice, by the way. And then I take you into a store and I show you how to shop. It's fun. I take you in several stores, show you how to shop in farmer's market and everything else, and then people on the street. Then I show you how to juice. So you're going to learn how to reverse heart disease and healing foods. It's all in the documentary. And in-depth information on diabetes, allergies, arthritis. So this is the documentary, brand new, Joy Juicing. This is the book, brand new, The Joy Juicing. And today you get them at a big discount. I'm not sure the discount, but it's a big discount. If you call until the copies run out, Then you can get them, I guess, at Barnes & Noble or Amazon. You can get them. Or you can get the book. The video is not available anywhere else. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Yeah, it's $30, and it would normally be $60. You're getting it half price. 877-627-5065. And until they're gone. When they're gone, they're gone. And then you can go to Amazon.com and get the Joy of Juicing book. Video not yet. One other quick program announcement. I'm going to do one really powerful hour this Friday. It may even run long. I have, I think, six medical doctors, board certified, and scientists, all women, coming on to talk about Gardasil. I want the world to know the truth about this fraud. We're challenging the legislators who receive money from the company itself, its science. We've done a lot of research on this. So let people know, this coming Friday, a major original investigative report live on the air. Plus, we'll be posting an article go with it. And we have people flying in from around the United States for this, because I'm also going to be filming them. And if you could volunteer, we're looking for some volunteers to pick these physicians up at the airport and bring them in the studio and take them back. Give Jeremy a call, 646-926-5434, 646-926-5434. Now, I want to go to a couple of issues that are important, and one is climate change, a little different look at climate change. Now, I'm going to share some information with you that I believe we need to know. If cities were stocks, according to William DuBois from TomDispatch.com, you'd want a short Phoenix. Now, of course, it's an easy city to pick on. The nation's 13th largest metropolitan area, nudging out Detroit, crams 4.3 million people into a low bowl in a hot desert where horrific heat waves and windstorms visit it regularly. It snuggles next to the nation's largest nuclear power plant, and having exhausted local sources, it depends on an improbable infrastructure to suck water from the distant and dwindling Colorado River, which, by the way, supplies water to over 40 million Americans. And when I was in Colorado last week, I got the latest on how low the Colorado River is and the Hoover Dam that challenged it and Lake Mead, and it's all bad, and it's not getting better, and it won't. In Phoenix, you don't ask what could go wrong, you ask what couldn't, and that's the point. Phoenix's multiple vulnerabilities, which are plenty daunting, take them one by one, have the capacity to magnify one another, like compounding illnesses. In this regard, it's a quintessentially modern city, a pyramid of complexities requiring large energy inputs to keep the whole apparatus humming. And the urban disasters of our time, think New Orleans, hit by Katrina, think New York City, swamped by Sandy, may arise from single storms, but the damage they do is the result of a chain reaction of failures. Remember I talked about on the show? The grid's going down, levees failing, backup systems not backing up. As you might expect, academics have come up with a name for such breakdowns: infrastructure failure interdependencies. You wouldn't want to use it in a poem, but it does catch an emerging theme of our time. Phoenix's pyramid of complexities looks shakier than most because it stands squarely in the crosshairs of climate change. The area, like much of the rest of American Southwest, is already hot and dry. Now here's the bad news. For the next at least 1,000 years, according to the latest report, not since 1,000 years have we seen a climate shift that goes this dry. So for years to come, if you live anywhere in the Southwest, the West, you're going to be in drier than ever in your lifetime a climate. It's not going to get better. And that is the problem. And also, we're concerned about rising sea levels to coastal cities and the strengthening of those storms. I predict that next year we'll probably see a Category 2, 3, 4, or 5 hit the East Coast in a major city. That we haven't had. That will be devastating. Are we prepared for it? No. Are we preparing for it? No. Are we overly optimistic and want to rebuild our homes right back out there on the dunes? Yes. Will we learn anything? We can't. If you want a taste of the brutal new climate to come, the place to look is where that climate is already harsh and growing more so, the aptly named Valley of the Sun. Now in Phoenix, it's the convergence of heat, drought, and violent winds interreacting and amplifying each other that you worry about. Generally speaking, in contemporary society, nothing that matters happens for just one reason. In Phoenix, there are all too many reasons primed to collaborate and produce big problems, with climate change foremost among them. Juicing up the heat, the drought, the wind to ever greater extremes, like so many sluggers on steroids. Notably, each of these nemesis, in its own way, has the potential to undermine the modern urban life, the electrical grid, which in Phoenix merits special attention. If in summer the grid there fails on a large scale and for a significant period of time, the fallout will make the consequences of Superstorm Sandy look mild. Sure, people will hunt madly for power outlets to charge their cell phones and struggle to keep their milk fresh, but communications and food refrigeration will not top their list of priorities. Phoenix is an air-conditioned city. If the power goes out, people fry. In just one recent summer, a heat wave swept Europe and killed 70,000 people. The temperature in London touched 100 degrees Fahrenheit for the first time since records had been kept. And in portions of France, the mercury climbed as high as 104. That's hot. Yes, yes, but that's child's play compared to Phoenix, where the readings commonly exceed 110, hitting 115. In fact, last year, the city set a new record for 110 degrees with over 33 days and more than 100 days over 100 degrees. How about that? That is a superheated day in a superheated Phoenix. Now, I can remember lecturing out in Phoenix. I remember walking down the street and stopping, and I had a newspaper, and as I was reading the newspaper, I felt something. It was my feet. My feet felt like they were on fire. And I was just curious. And I walked into a store, and I bought an egg, and I walked out, and I looked around, and nobody was looking, and I just knocked the egg and put it on this guy's hood. And it only took about 2 minutes to fry it. And then I wiped it off and cleaned it down. I was just curious, because my feet were actually so hot. Now, that's just a normal day. It goes without saying that Phoenix's desert setting is hot by nature, but we've made it hotter. The city is a masonry world with asphalt and concrete everywhere. The hard, heavy materials of its buildings and roads absorb heat effectively and efficiently and give it back more slowly than the naked land. In a sense, the whole city is really a thermal battery, soaking up every part of heat every day and releasing it at night. The result is an urban heat island, which in turn prevents the cool of the desert night from providing much relief. 60 years ago, when Phoenix was just embarking on its career of manic growth, nighttime lows never got above 90. Today, they rarely get below 100. So it's hot in the daytime, and you go out at 3 in the morning, and you burn your feet in the night. Well, that's not great. Studies indicate that Phoenix's urban heat island effect may boost nighttime temperatures by as much as 10 degrees. Predictably, the poor suffer from the heat the most. They live in the hottest neighborhoods with the least greenery to mitigate the heat island effect, and they possess the least resources for combating high temperatures. For most of the people living in Phoenix, none of this is more than an inconvenience as long as the air conditioning keeps humming and utility bill gets paid. When the heat intensifies, they learn to scurry from building to car and into the next building, essentially holding their breaths. In those cars, the second thing they touch after the ignition is the fan control for the air conditioning. The steering wheel comes later. In the blazing brilliance of July and August, you venture out undefended to walk or run, only in the half-light of dawn or dusk. The idea of residence, a phoenix, is to learn to dodge the heat, not challenge it. Heat, however, is a tricky adversary. It stresses everything, including electrical equipment. Transformers, when they get too hot, can fail. Likewise, thermoelectric generator stations, when fired by coal, gas, and neutrons, become less efficient as the mercury soars. And the great hydroelectric dams of the Colorado River, including Glen Canyon, which serves Greater Phoenix, won't be able to supply the peaking power they do now if the reservoirs behind them are fatally shrunken by drought. As multiple studies, and listen again, I'm giving you a heads up, every single study I could find proves beyond a shadow of a doubt you're running out of water to power your stations, to keep your air conditioning on. Phoenix, you are a fatally flawed city. So you've been warned, and it's not going to ever get better in your lifetime. So it's only going to get worse. And then we have something else. It comes from the Middle East. It's an Arab term. It's called Habub. H-A-B-O-O-B. It means the dust and the sand and the wind working together, creating windstorms, usually caused by the collapse of a thunderstorm cell. The plunging air hits the ground and roils outward, picking up debris across the open desert. As the Arabic name suggests, such storms are native to the arid areas in the Middle East. But although Phoenix is no stranger to storm-driven dust, the term has only lately entered the local lexicon. It seems to have been imported to describe a new class of storm. Remember, I'm talking about a brand new class of storm for the West. They sandblast cars. They close the airports. They cause the lights and air conditioning to go out. Well, you got utilities like the Phoenix Metroplex and the Arizona Public Service and the Salt River Project that says, not a problem. Not a problem today. What do you want to bet? It's going to be a big problem. What happens when you get someone caught in a sandstorm and it rips their skin off? How do you think that's going to look? Is that going to happen? Oh, yeah. It's inevitable in the very near future. But before Katrina hit, the Army Corps of Engineers was similarly reassuring the people of New Orleans. Remember that? And until Superstorm Sandy landed, almost no one worried about storm surges filling the subway tunnels of New York until WBAI looked out the window and they saw that the water was up to the top of the streetlight. Well, that was a wake-up call. Interesting, I had asked the program director at 5 o'clock that day, did they want to come up and use my studios? We would give them the studio so they wouldn't go off the air. No. A curt shout out. Okay. Then they're looking at where are the boats. Anybody got a life raft? God, man. Be prepared. Scout's motto. They weren't. Every system, like every city, has its vulnerabilities. Climate change in almost every instance will worsen them. The beefed up, juiced up, greenhouse gassed, overheated weather of the future will give us multiple haboobs of a sort you can't yet imagine, packed with even greater energy. It's all in the energy. In all likelihood, the emergence of such storms as a feature of Phoenix life results from an overheating environment abated by the loose sand and dust of abandoned farmlands dried up when water was diverted to the city's growing subdivisions. In dystopic portraits of Phoenix's unsustainable future, water, or rather the lack of it, is usually painted as the agent of collapse. Indeed, the metropolitan area, a jumble of jurisdictions that includes Scottsdale, Glendale, Mesa, Sun City, Chandler, and 15 other municipalities, long ago made full use of such local rivers as the Salt, Verde, and Gila. Next, people sank wells and mined enough groundwater to lower the water table by 400 feet. Sometimes the land sank. Near some wells, it subdivided even further down. All along, everyone knew that the furious extraction of groundwater couldn't last. But did anyone do anything about it? Not at all. They simply fixed their hopes on the new bonanza called the Central Arizona Project, a river-sized open-air canal supported by an elaborate array of pumps, sub-siphons, and tunnels that would bring Colorado River water across the breadth of Arizona to Phoenix and Tucson. What was called the CAP for Central Arizona Project came online in the early 1990s and today is the engine of Arizona's growth. Unfortunately, in order to win authorization and funding to build it, state officials had to make a bargain with the devil, which in this case turned out to be California. Arizona's delegation in the House of Representatives was tiny, California's was huge, and its representatives jealously protected their long-standing stranglehold on the Colorado River. The concession California forced on Arizona was simple. It had to agree that its CAP water rights would take second place to California's claims. This means one thing. Let's be clear. Once the inevitable day comes, and it will, when there isn't enough water to go around, the CAP will absorb the shortage down to the last drop before California even begins to turn off its faucets. A raw deal for Arizona? You bet. But not exactly the end of the line. Arizona has other more senior rights to the Colorado, and when the CAP begins to run dry, you can make sure that the masters of the CAP will pay whatever is necessary to lease those older water rights to keep the 330-mile canal flowing. Among other targets will be water rights belonging to Indian tribes at the western edge of the state along the lower reaches of the river, and the cost of buying tribal water will drive the rates consumers pay for water in Phoenix sky high. But they'll have no choice. You either pay it or you don't have air conditioning. Longer term, the Colorado River is running out of water. No amount of tribal water can resolve this. Beset by climate change, overuse, and drought, the river and its reservoirs, according to various researchers, may decline to the point that the water fails to pass Hoover Dam. In that case, the CAP would dry up, but so would the Colorado Aqueduct, which serves greater Los Angeles and San Diego, as well as All American Canal, on which the factory farms of California's Imperial and Coachella Valleys depend. Irrigators and municipalities downstream in Mexico will also go dry. If nothing changes in the current order of things, it is expected the possibility of such a debacle could loom in less than 9 years. That's what's happening. Just wanted to bring you up to date on the issues that make a difference. That's our public health issue. Now, mind you, I just selected Phoenix today. On upcoming programs, I'll show you Salt Lake. I'll show you Kansas City. I'll show you 100 towns that would never imagine that they'll run out of water and have dust storms that will dwarf anything from the Great Depression. But these are not just dust storms. These are sandstorms. And the energy that they're being forced by will cause enormous destruction. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going over to our guest who is standing by. And let us say hello now to Professor Rashid Khalidi. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm just going to ask you one basic question, and please take it as far as you wish to. As a statement, I'm concerned that I have not seen any administration be fair and honest in its approach to peace in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine. I see lip service, but I see AIPAC and other lobbying groups using their enormous clout to virtually steer the entirety of mainstream American media, the entire body politic, to support Israel's needs, both military and social, over the Palestinians, and always siding on that, and yet saying we want peace. Now I'm asking, how are you going to have peace when you don't have balance? Would you take us from your perspective with President Obama visiting Israel tomorrow and not visiting Gaza and not visiting going into the world's largest open-air prison, apartheid position? Would you tell us your concerns, what you see the problems are, and what is necessary if we're even begin to have a solution? The forum is yours.
Well, I think you've set it up very well. The book is titled "Brokers of Deceit" because I think that the pretense that the United States is a disinterested, even-handed broker, an honest broker in this is frankly a travesty. In fact, the United States, as I show in the book, using unclassified, recently declassified documents, the United States really since the 70s has accepted Israeli limitations on what could be allowed to the Palestinians that are so far below the minimum necessities for peacemaking, that I've argued this has never really been a peace process. This has essentially been a conflict, nor a conflict resolution process. This is a conflict maintenance, and I would argue process, and a process that has actually very much exacerbated the problem. The United States has helped to make this situation measurably worse over the past 35 years, starting with President Carter at Camp David acquiescing in the extraordinary limitations that the then Prime Minister Begin imposed on the Palestinians, right up to President Obama. All of them have mouthed support for a Palestinian state, but none of them, or for some rights for the Palestinians, but none of them have done the necessary things that would have actually brought us any closer to an equitable peace. In fact, the argument of the book is the United States has measurably helped in the creation of a structure which has made peace much, much more difficult, made a two-state solution, in my view, virtually unreachable. So I think it's, and as I argue in the book, it's not just a matter of the lobby or AIPAC or anything like that. It's a collection of factors which mean that the United States simply has not behaved in a just or an even-handed fashion in dealing with these two sides, and has not even served, in my view, the American national interest, which would be served by peace.
I'm concerned that we're willing to give Israel and other countries so much of our money when we are not willing to spend it on our own citizens' essential and basic needs. And could you tell us how much support we give and what kind of support we give, and how does that either contribute to continuation of the conflict, or at least doesn't solve any of the conflict?
Well, American aid to Israel is and has been for since 1973 the highest amount of aid to any country in the world. The United States, since the beginning, has given Israel over $115 billion. And Israel is one of the richest countries in the world at the moment. So there's this glaring disparity between actual need and between the amounts that we lavish on Israel. It's a huge chunk of the foreign aid budget. Second biggest recipient is Egypt. And most of this aid to Egypt and all of the aid to Israel is now military aid. So what the United States is actually doing, in my view, is contributing to conflict perpetuation by helping Israel to maintain a strategic hegemony over the region which is unchallengeable. I mean, you know, when you say these kinds of things in the United States, people think of tiny, poor, little Israel. Israel is one of the world's four or five or six most advanced military powers. It's one of the seven or eight nuclear powers. It's a country which towers over all of its potential adversaries. And the United States is helping not only to Israel to achieve this supremacy regionally, but is giving the weapons that are being used in fashions that I would argue are in gross violation of U.S. law, which indicates that weapons can only be used for self-defense. I'm not quite sure what form of self-defense is constituted by the pounding of Gaza back a few months ago in November of last year or in 2008, 2009. I'm not sure what kind of self-defense is being served by the use of these weapons in the occupied West Bank. So the United States is giving aid, which I would argue in most cases are just corporate subsidies, because foreign aid has to be spent in the United States. The money is not sent to these countries to be spent, you know, on poor people. It's only allowed to be used on American goods and services. So foreign aid is really just another form of corporate subsidy in the case of aid, most of the aid to Egypt and all the aid to Israel, subsidy to the arms, to the aerospace industry, and to other aspects of the military-industrial complex.
When you listen to Sean Hannity and the other apologists for this apartheid positioning, they continue to say, along with a lot of the religious right and a lot of the ministries, that it is the only democracy in the Middle East, and it's our best friend, and without that friendship and without their support, there would be a price to pay. Tell us what price that we pay for the way we have aligned ourselves, and tell us what you believe the actual position would be if we had a different outcome, if we chose to be fair and objective in our approach.
Well, one reason that so many people in the Middle East are so alienated from the United States, one of several reasons, is our unbalanced support for Israel. Obviously, we would have more friends if we weren't behaving as we have, in giving Israel unbridled support and acting in a manner that's very biased. Another reason, of course, is American military operations in the Arab world, in particular the invasion of Iraq. Overall, the American military presence in this region, all of these things have led people to be alienated from the United States. This argument that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, of course, is an ignorant argument that rests on two flawed pillars. The first is that there are actually other democracies in the Middle East. Lebanon is a functioning democracy. It's a very unsatisfactory democracy, but it is a democracy. You've had government succeed government within a constitutional framework since Lebanon was independent in 1943. Secondly, Kuwait, since it achieved its independence in 1961, with one brief exception, has had constitutional government. Now, it is a government where the ruling family has an inordinate share of power, but you have a free press, you have parliamentary elections, you have freedom of speech for Kuwaiti citizens. And so, you know, saying the only democracy in the Middle East ignores not only those two Arab countries, but also, for that matter, Turkey, which is also a democracy. So that's the first flawed pillar of the argument. The second is that while Israel is certainly a democracy in many respects, it has ruled since 1967, which in June will be 46 years, over a population which doesn't have any rights at all, which is to say the population of the occupied territories, people who are under complete Israeli control. They cannot enter or leave the country without Israeli say-so. They have to be registered by the Israelis, birth, deaths, and so on, or in Israeli hands. Israeli security forces control their movements, can interrogate them at any time, can enter into their homes, and so on and so forth. These people don't have any rights at all. So, yes, for Israeli citizens, there certainly is a democracy. There's discrimination against Arabs inside Israel, but there is democracy. They get it. They get the right to vote. They have their deputies in the Israeli Knesset. But it is, like many democracies, a very severely flawed democracy. It is, in many respects, I would argue, inside Israel, quite similar to countries in which there was rank discrimination against large minorities. Arabs inside Israel make up 20% of the citizens of the country. And that's not speaking of the 4 million-plus Palestinians who live in the occupied territories.
My final question, what do you believe would be the likely outcome if Israel is to convince the United States that it's absolutely essential that it invades Iran and starts a preemptive war with Iran based upon the notion that Iran has weapons or is developing weapons of mass destruction, nuclear bombs, and when the world's international community that's actually inspected has challenged that? And is that not very similar to what George Bush and all of his pundits and so-called neocon experts did to get us into the war with Iraq in 2003 and look at the consequences?
I think the likelihood of Israel dragging at least this administration into a war are very, very slim. Even back in the days of George W. Bush, who launched two wars, the Afghan War and the Iraq War, even back in the days of George W. Bush, when Vice President Cheney and a group of others tried to push the United States into giving Israel the wherewithal to launch a preemptive attack and to supporting that attack or possibly participating in it, there was enormous pushback from the U.S. military, from the intelligence community, and from American diplomats, who finally drew a line in the sand and convinced the president that this would be absolute and utter folly. It was unnecessary. Iran posed no threat whatsoever in 2003, 2004, 2005, the time that this debate took place. And all of the things that were being said by the Israelis, the hysterical claims about Iraq being on the point of achieving nuclear weapons, have been proven in the, what is it now, eight years since then, to be completely false, 7 or 8 years. And so even then, the military took a very clear line, arguing before the president that this would be complete folly. The same thing has happened in the Obama administration. Every branch of government that I have heard of has taken a very clear and very unequivocal stand against the United States either launching an attack on Iran or even on the premise for such an attack that it's necessary for U.S. national security, as well as against any endorsement or support by the United States for an Israeli strike. So I think that at the moment this is a very unlikely scenario, but it's one that citizens should be aware of, because it would be a very, very, very bad thing if it were to happen.
I appreciate the Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, your newest book. It's an important read, and thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Gary.
Professor Rashid Khalidi, K-H-A-L-I-D-I. I'm Gary Nall. That brings us up to the end of this particular program, and I thank you all very much for listening.